Stop it.
Good afternoon. We're going to call to order the Joint Committee on Public Safety. I want to thank everyone that's here today. We're going to have a number of individuals and panels that are going to be presenting today. This is informational hearing with invited testimony. Give you kind of a menu of what we'll be doing. We're first going to hear a presentation on the juvenile offenders program through the Oregon Youth Authority. Then we have two individuals that we'll be making contact with by phone. And then we have a third panel regarding Dick Whitnell and Darlene Hooley. Again, this will also be focusing on the components of the juvenile section of the 3194. And we'll complete some additional juvenile work with another panel that will be made up of individuals from Multnomah County, as well as the consortium out in central and eastern Oregon. I will tell the individuals that are guests that we have today, you'll be seeing members coming and going. This is one of those days where we have members have multiple obligations, so please don't be offended if you see people coming and going based on their schedules. They need to take care of a lot of items in the same day, unfortunately sometimes at the same time. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start with our first presentation. And Josh, do you need to do anything in the way of a layout?
No, sir.
All right, so our first panel is going to be with Fairbore. I understand you have two different panels that are two different sections. So why don't you go ahead and bring up, I believe it's Paul Blatty, and is it Brian Plum? Plum?
Yes.
Is he not coming up?
He's next. And just for, I know most of you, I think all of you have probably been here before, except for maybe Brian, when you give your testimony, we need you to put your name on the record.
Yes.
And we'll be glad to take it. So,
thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters, Prozanski, Garrett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fairbore Spaksoresh. I am the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm here this afternoon not to advocate for or against any measure or existing laws or statutes. Instead, my hope is to share with you some opportunities and challenges that exist in achieving optimum outcomes in reforming youth offenders. The juvenile system sits uniquely in between child welfare and adult corrections. And as you know, many of the youth who come to us have backgrounds of dependency, trauma, addiction, and abuse. But what separates them from the child welfare population is the crimes and the offenses that they have committed. Different strategies and interventions are required to address their needs and facilitate their path to reformation. What distinguishes youth from adults is the scientific fact that the brain is still developing up to age 25. For some of us, it might take longer. The youth OYA serves, with few exceptions, go back to the community at a young age and are at high risk of reverting back to a life of crime and possibly ending up in the adult correction system. Appropriate treatment and intervention and adequate support for reentry can increase their chance of success. The adult correction system focus is incarceration and determinant sentencing. You commit a crime, you're held for X period of time, you're released. The juvenile system, on the other hand, offers much flexibility. It is based not only on type of crime that you commit, but also on your risk and needs. The focus is reformation, accountability, and treatment. Research shows that applying adult corrections strategies to youth offenders can be detrimental to their success. The legislature created OYA with Senate Bill 1 nearly 20 years ago and charged it with creating interventions and treatment in order to return youth offenders back to communities as crime-free and productive citizens. With that charge in mind, OYA began working with our county partners and began developing a data system that 15 years later is the envy of all other states. Through the Juvenile Justice Information System, or JJIS, we have been able to collect valuable data that has allowed us to do analysis and design interventions that has put Oregon on the map as one of the most progressive states in dealing with juvenile population and juvenile offenders. Over the course of the past 18 years, the agency has used practices that provide treatment and interventions specific to the youth crime but also interventions that address underlying problems such as drug and alcohol issues, dependency, and mental health. Much of the treatment and programming that we provide focuses on teaching youth to take accountability and learn to make wiser decisions. Our youth also pay back the community through paying restitution to victims and through community service projects. In recent years, we have elevated the role of research and used the data that we have available in JAGES. We are now beginning to apply predictive analytics to help us create better outcomes for youth, reduce future victimization, increase public safety, and use resources most effectively. With the work that has been done in the past 2 years, not only are we able to create the outline of the best system possible in the nation, we can actually build that system. Today, we have the data to help us identify youth who may end up in our system years before that happens. By connecting with other databases from other departments, Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and we can provide that data to appropriate organizations with the hope of early intervention so that those youth can be diverted from our system and get on a better path. For those youth who ultimately end up in our system, we have the ability to identify the best placement, the right length of stay, how do we match those youth with the best programs, with the staff that actually have the ability to work with them, and ultimately allows us to create the best path to reformation. Well, with all of these promising things that I'm talking to you about, what's the problem and what's the challenge? Why am I here? Well, one of those challenges sitting right next to me on my right hand, not this guy here.
Highly suspect.
And actually, this is a great challenge to have. But the reality is that all of the things that I explained to you, everything that we can do with predictive analysis, which Dr. Baladi will talk about in a few moments, we can apply to our juvenile offenders. But when it comes to the population that comes to us through the adult court, we cannot apply those full range of options to that population. And that is the situation that Brian is in. Brian came to us 4.5 years ago and needed a lot of help. He took accountability for his actions, for his crimes. He'll talk about those in a few moments. He has stepped up and actively participated in his reformation. He will be receiving his bachelor's degree in June. In fact, today is his birthday, right? It is. 23 years old.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday.
And the problem, why Brian is a challenge, is that when he gets to his 25th birthday, 2 years from today, we are going to have to send him to the Department of Corrections for 18 more months. I think that in light of the progress that Brian has made personally and academically, and in light of owning his past, any parent would be proud to have him as their son. But the challenges that we face is twofold. One is that the space that he's occupying can be better used to serve somebody in real need. And the second piece is that, as I shared with you, in 2 years, we are going to have to send him to DOC for 18 months. And data and research tell us that youth offenders, when they're transferred to adult corrections, their chance of recidivism goes up by 100%. Does it make any sense, in light of the investments that we've made in Brian, to go down that path, and yet we can't do anything about that? So that's the problem I'm presenting you today. I'm glad I don't have to make these kinds of decisions, but certainly that is the challenge that I'm talking about. Now I would like to turn it over to Brian to share with you just a few minutes about his past and what he sees in his future.
For the record, my name is Brian Pham, and I would like to thank all of you for allowing me this opportunity to express such a vital part of my life. Prior to incarceration, I was a teenager who was veering towards a life that was absent of respect for myself, my family, and the community that I once belonged to. Overlooking the scruples that my family instilled in me when I was a child, I chose a different route in my life than what was originally intended. The route I chose led me to orchestrate an endeavor that would dramatically affect not only my life, but the life of the ones who care so much about me, and the life of the... Sorry, it's kind of difficult
for
me to say.
All right, take your time.
But the lives of the ones who deeply care so much about me and the ones that I committed my crime against. On September 9th of 2008, I was charged with robbery 1, burglary 2, and kidnapping 2. I began serving my Measure 11 sentence of 100 months at the age of 18. What initially seemed like a demoralizing event and a prerequisite to an uncertain future turned into a blessing that I would later realize in my life. The Oregon Youth Authority served as an incubator that allowed me to retrieve the scruples that I neglected early on, discover who I am as a person, and ignited a hunger for education and personal growth. I have achieved more in the 4.5 years that I've been with OIA than all the years leading up to my incarceration. Since being here, I've completed my required treatment, my high school diploma, my associate's degree, and with the help of Mr. Withnell over here, I'm able to say that I will complete my bachelor's degree in business administration this upcoming June. I noticed quite some time ago that some of the achievements that I made really only affected my own well-being, which caused my morality to demand something more of myself than self-indulgence. Because of this desire to help others in some aspect, I joined Project Pooch, a nonprofit organization that pairs shelter dogs with individuals, such as myself, in an effort to train and nurture them until a loving family is able to adopt them. I also participated in 3 leadership boards at McLaren and was recently appointed by the governor as a member of the Youth Development Council. Today, I am 23 years old, and before my 25th birthday, I will return to the Department of Corrections, where I fear my progress and growth will unquestionably be tested. I speak before you today not as some criminal or some youth offender, but as a human being who made a mistake and succeeded in reinventing myself. But you see, I'm only one of many, and I can assure you that if my peers were presented with the same opportunity to speak in front of you today, they would wholeheartedly divulge the immense amount of progress they too have made in their own lives. Thank you.
My good friend Dick Whitney wanted to make sure that I let all of you know that no public money has been spent or is spent on college education, and in fact, he might share with you how much money he's invested in Bad Boy, our youth. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Boladi to talk briefly about what predictive analytics is and what opportunity we have in Oregon to really build a system that is one of a kind in the nation.
Thanks, Bear Boers. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Paul Boladi. I'm administrator of research and projects at the Department of Corrections and research manager at the Oregon Youth Authority. And so I'm here today to talk a little bit about predictive analytics. And you may or may not know what predictive analytics are. Basically, predictive analytics are a series of tools and techniques that allow you to make some decisions about how to best impact outcomes in the future. And so what it really does is it distills information down and essentially allows you then to translate data into information and knowledge. And it's used extensively in the public sector. If you look at the healthcare system, they know what factors are associated with heart disease, with asthma, with diabetes. And the way they do that is they look at the individuals that have been affected by these ailments, look at individuals who have not, and compare them. And then the differences between those then are used to identify the characteristics or the tendencies in one's lifestyle that are actually increasing these risks. If you look at the most applied analytic that we have today is actually credit scoring. And credit scoring essentially uses information about your credit history, your salary, loan application information, and so on, to identify the likelihood that you're actually going to pay back the creditors on time. It's also used in online shopping. If you're looking at a particular item and something pops up on the side, some analyst has looked at this and said, many people that have looked at this particular item often buy this other one. What they're trying to do is increase the likelihood that you buy something. And there's also another type of predictive analytics known as neural network that mimics the mind and how it works. And it actually looks at junk mail and to increase the response rate. And, it doesn't sound like a whole lot, but when you can double the response rate, it actually has a tremendous influence on someone's bottom line. And so predictive analytics have been used extensively in the public sector. And basically what's happened is... private sector, excuse me, in the private sector. And And as a result, there's two types of companies or organizations, and those are the ones that either are overwhelmed by the data or use predictive analytics to get that edge that you see from a lot of the companies that are out there now. And so just like with the private sector, the public sector also has a lot of data. And there's four types of data that actually overwhelm organizations. And it's either the volume, the velocity, the variety, or the complexity that actually causes this company or organization to be overwhelmed. And in the public sector, we have large volumes, but we don't have the complexity and we don't have the variety. And it's because things have been siloed. In corrections, you have correctional data. In juvenile corrections, you have particular kinds of data. At DHS, you have other kinds of data. In the state police, they have yet another kind of data. These are rarely combined. And when you see in the private sector, they often are combined, and you can use this information a little bit differently. And so if we start combining data from these different resources, we're going to have to use the predictive analytics if we're going to continue to be effective. And so OIA has actually used some of these predictive analytics to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the programs that are provided at OIA, and I just want to talk about that briefly. And so what OIA is trying to do is find the best placement for the best opportunity for the right amount of time for each youth. And how do you go about doing that? How do you identify what the best placement is? And so if you rely on the data and you look at an individual that's coming in today, there have been hundreds that have come in before that are identical or very, very similar. And some of those have remained in the community, some have gone to residential, and some have gone to close custody. And if you look at the identical twins that are actually served in the community, you can ask, what is the recidivism rate of that group? Of those that go to residential, what is the recidivism rate of that particular group? And same with close custody. So as an individual enters, you can ask, what is the best setting for this particular youth? And it'll tell you something about the likelihood that this youth will succeed if you place them in this particular setting. And if, let's say, I'll use for an example residential treatment, you can take this a step further and say, of the 10 residential treatment opportunities that are currently available, what is the likelihood that this youth is going to succeed if we send them to residential treatment 1, residential treatment 2, and so on? And so each facility winds up with this equation. And for every youth that comes in, we can ask what is the likelihood of success. And so what you can do is, for each youth, you can put them in the right place, basically at the right time. So you can take that even a step further and ask for a particular treatment. Let's say there's 4 different cognitive behavioral treatment providers here in the state. You can ask which one's the best one. And so predictive analytics allows us then to develop these equations. And for each of those particular providers, you can look at the likelihood of success. So you can identify what's the best placement for the youth, what's the best setting, and the other question is, how long do they need to stay? And so for most of these providers, there's some youth that stay 3 months, some that stay 6 months, and some that stay 9 or 12 months. And if you look at the recidivism rate of those that stay 3 months versus those that stay 6, if those that stay 6 don't have a lower recidivism rate, it's probably not an effective treatment. And eventually, you see diminishing returns. And when you get down to the bottom and you see fewer and fewer returns, you have to ask, are we actually using our resources effectively at that point? And so when you provide this information to a treatment provider, and let's say the optimum length of stay is 9 months, you should see on average that most of these youth will stay 9 months. Some will stay 6 months, some will stay 12 months, but on average you should see that most of them stay about 9 months. And so it's an effective use of our resources. And so if you use those analytics coupled with some other things like cost-benefit analysis and look at the feeder systems and identify the characteristics of individuals and families that increase the risk that they come to OIA, and you look at the factors that are associated with failed transition, you should be able to move towards an ideal system. And the ideal system is to minimize the recidivism rate with the resources that we have. We're never going to get it to zero, but the question is, how low can we get it? And if we align the youth with the services that we currently have, you should be able to get it as low as possible. So if there's no other, if there's questions, I'm more than willing to entertain them now, or I'll hand this back to Faribault for some concluding remarks.
Why don't we do the concluding remarks, and then we'll open up for questions for everyone.
So in conclusion, I just want to say that we are on the verge of a breakthrough in Oregon as far as how we can use data to create best outcomes for youth. As far as Brian goes here, as he said very effectively, there are many other youth like him in the system who, by every indicator that we have, they're ready to go. They have done all of their work. This youth here, Brian here, has done everything that we've asked him to do. Today, he can be working in the community. He can be paying taxes. He can be under supervision. We can pull him back anytime we want to. But the reality is that he is sitting. We love having him. He's being a mentor to many other kids. But that's not the best use of our resources. Again, you know, that's a challenge that we face. And the biggest challenge that we face is what do we do for that 18 months? You know, as great as Department of Corrections in Oregon does, you know, my former director, Colette Peters, will sit in front of you and say the same thing. Sending youth, national data, local data shows that sending youth to adult corrections will increase their chance of recidivism by 100%. So how do we want to deal with the investment that we've made in Brian and in youth like him, given that the charge of our system is not just incarcerating kids, but actually doing programming to help them become productive citizens? What is the answer to that? And I'm glad I don't have to answer that. You need to answer that. So with that, you know, if you have any questions, we'd be glad to answer them.
All right, let's see. Questions, comments? I've got some. If no one else, I'll start. I guess I want to start off, Brian, with yourself as to what you've been able to do. What I've heard in the testimony from yourself and as well as from the director, incentives were a key component that gave you reason to move forward. Is that a fair assessment?
You mentioned incentives.
Yes.
I think more than anything, an individual needs to create some form of intrinsic motivators. And by coming to jail, by being incarcerated within the Oregon Youth Authority, I really realized that I needed to improve myself, and I didn't want to rely on anybody other than myself in the future. And I think that's what really did it for me. Those okay. intrinsic motivators.
And then, Director, if we, in the sense, let's say, in the best of all worlds, of your world, if we had a mechanism to have Brian released back into the community, understand you have the authority and retain the authority, could you walk the panel through as to what length of time you would have, and also if you can kind of walk us through what would be the steps that would be taken? We've heard on the adult side reentry programs. And I know we're kind of in a little different situation here. If you can kind of maybe give us a picture of how that could work for juveniles.
Certainly, Co-Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. I think currently when you look at the juvenile system, we have that flexibility and we have that ability. We have step-down programs. If we had the ability with Brian, probably even last year, we would have placed him in a residential setting as a step-down program to transition back into his community. He would be monitored by a juvenile parole and probation officer who would be checking in with him, and Brian would have the responsibility to check with his PO periodically, perhaps, you know, several times a week. If he was going to school, the parole officer would make sure that the attendance is taking place. If we would see deviations in the plan that we have created for him, we would be having the conversation with him. If he did something wrong, we always have the ability to pull him back into the facility for what some of our professionals call tune-ups, you know, maybe keep him for 30 days and help him get back into the community. Frankly, one of the biggest challenges that we face in the system is that the kids, and this is the main difference between juveniles and adults. The vast majority of these youth suffer from issues in the past and lack the basic skill sets to operate as a productive member of society. So one of the biggest pieces that we have to do with these folks, not necessarily in the case of Brian, is a skill building. How do you resolve a conflict? How do you operate in a school setting where how do you sit in a bus and talk to a member of the opposite sex? So we have reintegration providers who actually work with youth as to how do we best reintegrate this youth back into the community. You use the word reentry. that's probably the most important piece of these youth success. And in the case of youth, quite often, at times, again, this is not the case for Brian, but some of these youth come from environments and families that's not best for them to go back to. So then it becomes our job to find that right reentry for them. And the challenge that we have today is that in the case of adult commits, meaning people, a youth like Brian, when they're, if he was being released from Oregon Youth Authority, where his sentence would come to an end, we basically would just put him out there, and then he would have to go into adult community corrections when there is not a whole lot of resources to help him. And we do have this problem in the system. There are some of the youth that are released from our system under the age of 18, and it's really difficult to find resources for them in the community. We can do that in the juvenile system. So in my best world, we would be able to do exactly with Brian as we do with our juvenile commits, based on his progress, and given that all the indicators point that he's ready to go, we would put him out there.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have
Director,
one more.
You're going to stay here, and Izzy's coming up.
Well, and thank you, Brian.
You're very welcome. Right.
Thank you very much for coming forward and sharing your story.
Thank you very much for having me.
And my thanks to my former director, Colette Peters, and Department of Corrections for allowing Brian to come here today.
I do have one, because you, Fairbairn, you did just kind of briefly talked about, and you might want to explain just a little bit more to the panel, the work that you are doing with child welfare and youth and DOC, because we have just started having those discussions about the data sharing and the hope of what will come out of that.
Thank you, Senator Winters. And again, this was a meeting that occurred some a few months back, and Senator Prozanski, you were on the phone. Senator Winters was in the room, and what you asked us and encouraged us to do was to share data and combine databases to basically apply these predictive analytics. Again, today we have the opportunity to identify, by connecting our database with the Department of Human Services database, identify youth at a very early age, perhaps even at birth, who are on a trajectory to perhaps end up in our system or Department of Corrections. How can we do that? Some of the same things Dr. Baladi talked about, dynamics such as family dynamics, education, income, crime level, addiction. What that allows us to do is to begin making early investment. We can do the same thing with Department of Education. You know, school attendance is one of the factors that we can take into consideration, and we hope to do that shortly. We are in the process of doing it. And as all of you know, sometimes just getting our hands on data and sharing it, especially in a system that has operated as silos, is a bit challenging. But with your help, we're moving forward on that.
Thank you.
And I'll turn it over to Izzy Cavazos, one of our staff, who's going to share some of his experience. He works directly with you.
Co-chairs and members of the Joint Committee, my name is Izzy Cavazos, and I will provide testimony attempting to capture a 17-year history of working with youth at both the Oregon Youth Authority, where I presently am employed, and with nonprofit organizations. In all these cases, my history in working with young people who have made bad choices and are being held accountable either through incarceration and or supervision. Presently, I'm working with this population in two ways. First, I co-chair an advisory board for the Cavazos Center, which was named after my father, who has recently passed. The center is an organization that helps Latino youth who have been adjudicated and in the juvenile justice system. We help them learn the skills and behaviors to establish healthy relationships and live productive lives as part of their families and communities. Secondly, I'm a group life coordinator at Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility, located here in Salem. At that facility, 12 to 25-year-old males, youth, are housed and provided with treatment that works to both hold them accountable for their crimes and ensure that when they re-enter our communities, they have the skills necessary to make it on the outside. I work directly with youth who have been committed to our facility. Currently, I work in a program with youth that are chemically dependent. on drugs and or alcohol. Our program is a 5 to 7 month placement, depending on individualized treatment needs. Other staff and I engage with youth in a strength-based approach to their behaviors, and by introducing treatment curriculum we have been trained in, such as seeking safety, anger replacement therapy, changing offender behavior, as well as drug and alcohol-specific curriculum in pathways to change, and cannabis youth treatment, just to name a few. Some youth can finish treatment quickly while others take longer. We have youth who have disabilities and process information slowly. Our program can still be effective with them, but sometimes it takes a while longer for them to sink in what we're trying to teach them. Those youth need to be with us longer than others. This is one example of one size of incarceration not fitting everyone. Often youth who come to OIA do really poorly for the first year. They are despondent, have realized the magnitude of the bad choices that they've made and how that impacts not only themselves but others. This first year often looks bad on their institutional record, but we know that it's part of how they accept the consequences of what they have done and adapt to life in an institution. Sometimes youth who are serving a Measure 11 sentence, or we call it Department of Corrections or DOC commit, they end up getting transferred to an adult prison as they age out or because we can't control their behavior. We know the youth who get sent to adult prison have horrible outcomes, so OIA tries not to send them to DOC when possible. I personally hate to see it when youth within OIA have finished all their programming and then there's no place else for them to go. Unfortunately, the minimum sentencing guidelines in place have a one-size-fits-all policy to what we refer to as a rainbow of youth, not just in the relation to their colors of their skin, but in the variety of personalities and needs for treatment. Some of these youth end up doing what we call dead time in our facility. They have been through treatment, made amends for the wrongs, and they are committed and showing progress. But because of the strict sentences and no second look, they're not able to move along and out of our system. Their learning and development stops as they wait out the remainder of their sentencing. Some of them end up going to the adult prison. This is a sad situation for me personally and my coworkers to witness. We have worked hard to help these youth turn their lives around and want to see them continue in their progress. In our work at OIA, we see youth are changing their behaviors and we have evidence of successfully reducing recidivism rates. I see it daily. In my work with the Latino youth at the Cavazos Center, I see successful transitions to productive life, and I am extremely optimistic that currently OIA's role in carrying out incarceration with appropriate treatment also prepares youth for successful reentry and return to some level of normalcy. I would like to thank the committee for the important work you are doing to create even an even better public safety system for Oregon, particularly for youth.
Izzy, thank you very much. Any questions? Senator Roblin?
Thank you. Just a comment. Having the opportunity to visit your facility the other day and listening to both students that were there and your officers, and then hearing your story in particular, you know, I just want to comment that actually being as willing as you are to committed to the science of this and to making sure that even when other people in the organization don't particularly like your decisions, but that you have a belief that you're willing to carry it forward is what we need. I mean, it takes people with a real commitment to understand what's going on. And I was impressed with the visit. I was impressed with the stories that I heard. And the stories particularly from some of the young people whose lives have been transformed. So I just want to commend you for that work.
Thank you, Senator Roblin.
Yep. Any other comments or questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for the presentation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So our next panel is going to be by phone. We're going to have two individual phone calls, and for members of the committee, on your desk you'll find an adolescent development and justice policy handout that will be for our first individual that will be speaking, which is Dr. Jennifer Woolard.
Hello, this is Jen Woolard.
Hi, Dr. Woolard. This is Floyd Przonski. I'm one of the co-chairs for the Joint Committee on Public Safety. I hope you're doing well this afternoon.
I am. I hope you are as well.
Thank you. We have you live on the hearing room, and we're going to take your testimony next. I wanted to appreciate, I know that you're on the East Coast, that you're hanging in there before you probably make your commute.
Quite all right.
So if you would be so kind to give us your name, and then we'll take your testimony, and we'll see if there's any questions or comments afterwards.
Sure, absolutely. You want me to go ahead and start now?
Yes, please.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Woolard. I'm an associate professor of psychology at Georgetown University. Co-chairs and members of the Joint Committee on Public Safety, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon about adolescent development and juvenile policy. Today I'm going to share with you some of what the behavioral science research can contribute to the policy discussion about responses to youth. But before I briefly review that research, I want to clarify my purpose today. Some folks mistakenly interpret a discussion of developmental differences that I'm going to share with you today as a claim that adolescents should not be held accountable for their actions. Having worked myself in a victim witness program based in a police department, staffed a state commission on violence prevention, and sat across the dinner table for more than 20 years with a career prosecutor husband who is now a judge, both my personal and professional experience have emphasized to me the importance of an approach to juvenile offending that protects public safety, reduces risk, and maximizes the chances for adolescents to develop into productive, law-abiding adults. So today, though, I don't need to rely on my personal or professional experience, but instead can bring you scientific evidence to inform the policy choices and challenges that you face. First of all, I want to confirm that adolescents are developmentally different from adults in ways that are relevant to delinquency and crime. This statement is not based in stereotype or intuition, but in science. Although the belief that adolescents are different may be longstanding, the news is that advances in behavioral and brain research support this fundamental tenet of the juvenile justice system and its approach to rehabilitation. If you all, I sent some slides ahead. I'm sorry that I'm not actually physically there to be able to do this, but if you all have those slides in front of you, if you will flip from the cover slide to slide 2, and I'll just let you know throughout the time when to flip, you'll see a picture of brain development. The brain continues to develop structurally, which means changes in the physical aspects of the brain, and functionally, or changes in the way the brain works throughout adolescence into adulthood. So in that picture that you have on slide 2, you see the brain developing from age 5 to age 20. The gray matter, if there's more gray matter in the red and less in the blue. And so what you can see is from age 5 to age 20, the brain is turning blue. Not literally, of course, but this represents that the gray matter is decreasing as the brain matures and the neural connections in the brain are pruned or shaped. The prefrontal cortex at the front of the brain, which is responsible for executive function, or what we sometimes call the CEO of the brain, you can see is among the last to mature of the entire brain. So to illustrate how this brain development is relevant, I want to focus on two major aspects of brain and behavior functioning in teenagers. If you can move to slide 3. What I'm going to do is use a bit of a model rather than talking about details of the brain, and I'm going to recommend that it's helpful for us to think about two distinct sets of brain systems that are relevant to the adolescent behavior that may bring them to the juvenile justice system. These two systems are in different regions or parts of the brain, and they mature along different timetables. I'm going to talk about the socio-emotional system and the cognitive control system. So if you can flip to the next slide.
Okay.
I can hear the paper turning, so that's a good sign.
We're with you.
All right. The socio-emotional system, or the socio-emotional network, refers to parts of the brain that are responsible for emotion, for understanding rewards, for social processing. And this system undergoes major changes in early adolescence, which is also a time, as we know, of increased sensation-seeking, increased and easier emotional arousal, so what we call lability, that up and down from moment to moment. In my household with my teenagers, going from you're the best mom ever to the, you're the worst mom ever in a matter of moments, and increased attentiveness to social information. So adolescence is characterized by this socio-emotional system that's easily aroused and highly sensitive to social feedback. Okay? If you'll flip to the next page, we'll talk about that second system for a moment, the cognitive control system. So at the same time that we have that socio-emotional network happening, adolescence is characterized by a still immature cognitive control system. Although, sadly enough, for those of us over the age of 16, IQ tends to peak by about the age of 16, the capacity for planning, for being oriented towards the future, and the ability to regulate yourself, self-regulation, those portions of the brain continue to develop well into young adulthood. So as I mentioned, sometimes this area is called the CEO of the brain. These areas activate during what we might consider mature or deliberate thinking, right? So the ability to identify and consider future consequences, to understand possible sequences of events. If this happens, then this is likely to happen, and then that might happen. And also to control our impulses. Okay? So if you flip to the next slide, as a result then, what does it mean that these two systems are developing on these different timetables and are developing normally during adolescence? Well, it means that teens are less able to control their impulses, are less able to resist pressure from peers, less likely to think ahead, and more driven by the thrill of rewards. And this is a function of normative or normal development. We also know that these effects of immaturity are probably even greater outside the laboratory where a lot of these are tested. So compared to adults, juveniles' cognitive capacity is undermined by that socio-emotional system, right? And it's undermined in circumstances that are not controlled, that are not deliberate, and that are not calm, circumstances that may encompass much of the circumstances for risk of adolescent delinquency. So the brain and behavior research and theory suggests to us that with maturation comes the integration of those two systems, bringing their influence into greater balance and perhaps contributing to the reduction in risky behavior that we see as adolescents move into young adulthood. I do want to be clear about one thing. The advances in these brain imaging techniques are exciting. They offer windows into the structure and the function of the brain that we could only dream about 20 years ago. But this research is still developing, so we can't definitively tell you that certain regions of the brain are responsible for risky behavior, for immature thinking, or delinquent acts. But what we can tell you is that our initial brain research is consistent with the decades of behavioral research that have documented important differences in the cognitive or thinking capacities, in the psychosocial and emotional development, and in the behavior of adolescents compared to adults. So if you could flip to the next slide, slide 7. Let me start off with what this research doesn't mean, though. It doesn't mean that adolescents don't know right from wrong. It doesn't mean that they're the same as young children. And it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be held responsible for their actions. It also doesn't mean that all juvenile offenders are exactly the same. So I believe that this body of behavioral and brain research that I've summarized in 2 minutes calls into question assumptions made by some that juveniles or some juveniles are simply miniature adults, incapable of or unlikely to change, simply because they are capable of committing certain offenses. So prior to age 16, we know that youth are different intellectually and emotionally from adults. After age 16, they're still different emotionally and are still developing those self-regulation capacities that they can achieve once they are in young adulthood. Now, there are certainly adults who engage in risky behavior or act immaturely. The crucial distinction, though, that I want to make is that adolescents as a class or as a group are more likely to demonstrate these deficiencies due to normative development that is incomplete. So we know most youth will mature into law-abiding, productive adult citizens. As a result, this research on developmental differences challenges policymakers and practitioners alike to sort and to manage a young population that can appear simultaneously adult-like and immature. So, what guidance can developmental research provide? And here you can flip to the next slide. The importance of considering rehabilitation and amenability to treatment as we consider youth in long-term incarceration is a critical issue, particularly for youth incarcerated as adults. Youth's foreshortened time perspective, for example, can mean that the same amount of time in isolation imposed for disciplinary sanctions for adults can have a more severe or excessive impact on youth. One study comparing the perceptions of youth transferred to the adult system with those retained in the juvenile system found that youths reported that juvenile sanctions had an effect because they gained something, skills, hope, services, reflective of the testimony that you heard a little bit earlier today. They reported that adult sanctions, though, tended to have an effect on attitudes and behavior, if they did, because they cost them something, a loss of hope, a loss of safety, a loss of respect. So sanctions imposed on juvenile offenders should hold them responsible, but shouldn't harm them in ways that imperil their development or increase the likelihood that they will recidivate. So it's incumbent upon us as researchers, and I think respectfully you all as policymakers, to ask questions about outcomes that extend beyond recidivism to include pathways of development. How can youth develop appropriate relationships? How do they develop their own skills? And positive engagement in the larger society through employment and other kinds of outcomes. So the emphasis on and the possibility for rehabilitation is crucial. The research findings that I've briefly summarized today and the body of research underneath them at a minimum support the importance of a developmentally appropriate juvenile justice system that simultaneously works to prevent and reduce offending while augmenting the opportunity for youth to follow a successful and productive developmental pathway. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Wollett. Let me see if anyone has any questions based on the presentation.
I just would wonder, Doctor, if you put an age, chronological age on any of that, at what's the turning point? In Oregon, the law has a juvenile at 17, adult at 18.
Right. You mean in terms of the brain and behavior research that I was talking about?
Yes.
Well, in some of the studies that we have done where we studied folks from age 10 up to age 30 on some of these things, we found that the socio-emotional development, that psychosocial stuff I was talking about, future planning, risk assessment, and so forth, continued to develop well into the 20s. We actually thought by 30 we would have captured it all, and it was still continuing to develop. So in that case, we really see, you know, I understand that the juvenile system and legal adulthood is a different question, yeah, but we do see continued development in those capacities well into the 20s.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome.
All right. First, I've got Senator Rowland, and then we'll come back with Representative Olson.
And thank you for being here with us. Is there any research being done that shows how drug influence as an adolescent changes this brain chemistry even longer or changes it in different ways?
Right. That's a terrific question. And I should say that I don't directly study the substance use issues myself, but have a lot of colleagues that do. And we see both in the kind of brain research that I was talking about, in studying the brain itself, as well as the behavioral research, that substance use and abuse can have a profound impact. And I guess the best way that I could describe it is we could think about it as delaying or interfering with that maturity timetable that I was talking about. So if you want to take the normative development and growth that I was describing, when you lay substance use and abuse on top of that, it drags that back even further or extends it out farther, if that makes sense.
So my follow-up would be, so if you can get them out of off the drugs and do that rehabilitation, the chances are they kind of start reset and you start over, so you still got a ways to get that maturity to get to be fully mature brains.
Right, and I should say it's not as though we have an intervention that, you know, can catch kids up on maturity in that way, but you're absolutely right that it would be really critical and helpful to development for that substance use and abuse to stop.
Right. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Dr. Hay, thank you for calling in today. My name is Andy Olson, state representative out of the Albany area, south of Salem here. But I appreciate your thoughts on the immature juveniles who will almost always grow into mature and law-abiding adults. Every month I meet with about seven different judges from my area down in the Mid-Valley here, and I've been discussing with them a number of the issues that we've been facing with here in this committee. One of the issues that I shared with was that specifically about the immature juveniles growing into a mature, hopeful, law-abiding adult. One of the judges shared with me, because he's deeply involved with the juvenile justice side of things, I thought it was rather interesting, but, and I'm just curious your take on this with what you've said, is what do you do with the youth offender who has committed multiple burglaries, and the only reason that that individual feels that he's done anything wrong is that he's been caught?
Right. So coming back to that question about that one that your young panelist was talking about earlier in terms of the personal accountability, right, and responsibility. Well, certainly in that case, when you have a youth with multiple offenses and a youth that's not understanding or at least accepting responsibility, right, then that is a youth that's prime for some intervention, right, in that happening. What I couldn't tell you just based on that, and I'm not even sure how well we could do it if we had the youth in front of us, is whether that lack of accountability or responsibility in that individual case, right, is something that the youth just needs to grow up a little more to get, or if that's more of an individual choice, right, on the part of that youth, or a deliberate decision not to accept responsibility. So there certainly are a wide range of juveniles with a wide range of backgrounds, right, proclivity to offend and all those kinds of things. So my take on that case would be to defer to the folks who are on the ground with that youth in front of them, right, in terms of what would be the best way to match interventions and services that could try to minimize the likelihood that he's going to be offending again or anytime soon, but at the same time to place those structures and supports around him that's going to maximize the likelihood that this positive development and this personal accountability is going to occur. I hope that doesn't sound like I was dodging your question, but that's my best way to talk about it in the abstract at this point.
Well, I can't see you physically, so I can't tell you what you were doing. Okay, thank you.
I'll just declare it up front.
Okay.
Other comments, questions?
Representative Matthews. Thank you, and thank you, Doctor, for your testimony. I'm just curious from a different angle. Have there been studies that show perhaps the impact to a victim and how this might imperil their development through life so that we can at least put that in the context as well as we look at some of these offensing guidelines or the offense guidelines and sentencing? We also need to kind of take it from a perspective of what's the impact to a victim and how does that affect their lives moving forward?
Sure. So let me just make sure I understand. You're talking about a victim who would be a victim of a juvenile crime, not a juvenile offender who might also be a victim, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. No, absolutely. And as I mentioned before, you know, I've in my history responded in the middle of the night to victims of serious juvenile crime and serious offending. So I appreciate the question and I appreciate the attention to that side of the equation. Certainly, victimization can have a wide range of effect on the victims themselves, on the victim's family, right? We can talk about secondary victimization and so forth. And I've always been a strong believer that the victim perspective needs to be taken into account and built into the system, which a lot of reforms have happened over the past years to do that. So I think, two things. I'd say one is that is an important perspective to take into account. And there certainly have been initiatives around the country and probably I'm imagining in your own districts that have worked in certain cases when it's appropriate around victim-offender reconciliation and mediation and victim impact statements and all of those kinds of things that really make sure that juveniles understand that their actions do have impact and can have quite significant impact. Certainly those things, in some cases, cannot repair or restore the damage that has been done, but certainly forces the conversation, right, and perhaps allows the victim, if he or she wanted, to be able to have that opportunity to hear from the offender and or to respond to the offender. So that would be one thing that I would say. The second thing that I would say is I don't think the developmental research in any way that I've talked about undermines or contradicts that perspective either. And certainly a focus as a part of the developmental process and or the justice system response to adolescent offenders can and probably should incorporate that perspective into that response. So I would acknowledge and emphasize the importance of examining impact on the victim and thinking about ways that that information can be incorporated appropriately and safely into our responses to the offenders.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. Senator Jackie Winters, and you. I want to follow back up because you, on the victim who has also been a victim, we have a number of juvenile offenders who have experienced some within their families and have, I also serve on human services, so I'm aware of the height of child abuse and neglect and some of those issues. What effect does that have on the developmental process?
That's a terrific question. Thanks for asking that. And we do certainly know that both for boys and girls, right, that are offenders coming up through the system, that there is a much greater prevalence compared to juveniles not in the system of the kinds of victimization experiences that you talked about. Particularly we know for girls, but also for boys in many ways. So in terms of thinking about the impact of victimization on development, which I think was your question, I would say that we certainly can say that victimization can be a risk factor for offending. By no means do I mean that it's determinative, but we do find in many juvenile offender populations this history, right, of problems within the family, of personal victimization, of family violence, and so forth. I think the recent attention over the past several years within the justice system to trauma-informed care and trauma-informed responses is incredibly important and appropriate because our attention to trying to minimize recidivism and maximize public safety and improve the likelihood of rehabilitation has got to take into account, I think, those significant childhood or adolescent experiences of victimization in helping the offender come to terms with that, perhaps, to receive services for that. They may have been undetected and undiagnosed, but then also to incorporate that into the kinds of day-to-day responses, right, to have the kind of response that's informed by knowledge about what trauma is, what victimization can do, and how to appropriately respond.
All right, thank you. Senator Rowland.
Yeah, one last question from mine, and it's a follow-up of our Representative Olson. And the child that had multiple offenses, you know, we've heard about a number of tools that are used in probation and for the adult population that can indicate whether the person has a criminality of mind as opposed to more or less likely to recommit, and that how we handle them in the probation system adults is obviously different based on some of that information. If you want to have success with recidivism. The question I have is that starting to develop already in adolescence, but is there still more of a chance to turn that brain around as an adolescent than it is as an adult, or do we have that kind of studies?
Also a terrific question, and I'll have to say I'm not entirely sure what falls under the concept of criminality of mind in your jurisdictions. I don't know if folks are talking about kind of, you know, budding significant mental illness or psychopathy or something like that, or if they're talking more about kind of personality and attitudes that might influence or increase the risk of continuing to engage in criminal behavior. To the second part of your question, can the brain be turned around and so forth in adolescents compared to adults? I know that the slide that I sent you all is a static slide, so you can't see the great picture, moving picture of the developing brain, but there's just a tremendous amount of growth and change happening during this adolescent time period in the brain, right? So not only is that selective pruning, just like you think about pruning a bush, right, all of those connections are pruned back to the more important ones, but all of those pathways between parts of the brain are getting interconnected. So an analogy would be moving through adolescence, right, childhood into adolescence into young adulthood, the brain pathways are moving right from the two-lane dirt road to the neighborhood road to the interstate to the superhighway in terms of the connections between different parts of the brain and the speed and efficiency that those parts can communicate to each other. So with saying that, then I would say the brain can undergo really significant and dramatic changes during that time period because it's already, in a sense, a moving target, right, with all of these changes. Now, we know that the brain can continue to develop and to change well into adulthood, and some studies are even showing, you know, in aging and older populations. But the big job of adolescence with the brain is to develop in these really dramatic ways. So I can't definitively say to you a brain can turn around, you know, in that way in an individual, but we know that there's tremendous potential for growth and amenability and change during adolescence.
Doctor, thank you very much. I do have, I guess this is more for context. I understand the area that you work on is more in the adolescence, and you talked about various colleagues doing other work. Mm-hmm. I believe there's a professor at the University of Oregon, if I remember her name correctly, Helen Neville, who does work in with early childhood brain development. Are you familiar with her work?
I'm not personally or individually, no.
Okay, thank you very much. Any last comments? Doctor, again, thank you for taking your time on your Friday afternoon. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thanks for the invitation. You all too.
All right, we're going to disconnect here so we can make connection with our next caller. You're more than welcome to follow us. It sounds like you've been following us online, and again, thank you.
You're most welcome. Thank you all. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello, excuse me, Dr. Bishop, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm just fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. This is Floyd Przanski. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Joint Committee on Public Safety. Thank you very much for taking time on your Friday afternoon or early evening to be with us. We do have you on live at the hearing room, and what we'd like for you to do is go ahead and give us your presentation with your name first, and then afterwards we'll take questions from the panel.
Okay, certainly. My name is Donna Bishop, and I'm a professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University in Boston. And I've been asked to talk a little bit with you today about my and others' research on the effects of transferring young offenders into the adult system. There have been several studies that have been carried out in different jurisdictions looking at youth who were transferred into the adult system and comparing their outcomes to youth who were retained in the juvenile system. They've used different methodologies, some weaker and some stronger, and I'd like to focus my attention today on the couple of studies that have used very strong methodological designs and that have produced some results consistent with each other and that's fairly rare in social science research. The first research that I want to talk about was conducted by Jeffrey Fagan, a professor at Columbia University. He conducted what we call a natural experiment. He compared 400 15 and 16-year-old boys who were processed in criminal courts in New York City with 400 15 and 16-year-old boys that were processed in New Jersey, where because of the different laws in the two states, the youth in New York were processed in criminal court and the youth in New Jersey were processed in juvenile court. These were all armed robbers and burglars, and he followed them up for a period of 7 years to look at their offending patterns after they had been released. What he found was that for the burglars, there were no differences in reoffending between youths who were transferred and those who were retained in the juvenile system. But for the robbers, the more violent youths, the youths who had been transferred were 30% more likely to be rearrested than the youth who'd been retained in the juvenile system. The transfers also reoffended more quickly, and in terms of their frequency of reoffending, they reoffended at 75% higher rates. My own research, which was conducted in Florida, Florida is a state that has a very broad transfer law, and prosecutors have the discretion to direct file cases in criminal court or to retain them in juvenile court. I and my colleagues at the University of Florida compared over 2,000 kids that had been transferred to the adult system with a matched group of 2,000 kids who were retained in the juvenile system. Now, we matched the two groups in terms of the most serious offense, the number of counts that they were charged with, the number of prior referrals they'd had to the juvenile system, the most serious prior offense that they'd had, as well as age, gender, and race. After 3 years, we found that the transfers were nearly twice as likely to be rearrested as the youth in the juvenile system. Like Professor Fagan, we also found that they were more likely to offend at higher rates, and also they were more likely to be arrested for serious felony crimes. We followed that up with another study done at 7 years with the same group, and found that still arrest was more prevalent among the transfers in 6 out of 7 offense categories. I should mention also that the offense category in which they did not differ was the burglary category, which is the same category that Fagan had found no differences. We also found that there was a higher reoffense rate for transfers who had initially been convicted of violent crimes. Now, when we presented our results, in Florida to judges and prosecutors, and we got a good bit of feedback, especially from the prosecutors, and they told us that perhaps our results were an indication of the fact that we hadn't taken account of some things that they take account of in making decisions to prosecute kids in the adult system. We listened to what they indicated were the things that they especially were concerned about, things like weapon use and victim injury, whether or not the youth was involved in a gang, whether there were adult co-defendants, and so forth. And based on their feedback to us, we created another study in which we were able to generate 315 pairs of youths, that is 630 youths total, where we matched on all of the criteria that prosecutors told us they were using to make decisions about whether or not to transfer. So these are our best matched pairs, which is probably the most significant research that's been done. And what we found was that into adulthood, half of the transfers were rearrested for a felony crime, compared to 37% of the kids who were retained in the juvenile system. And the transfers were significantly more likely to be rearrested for a violent felony crime. So what this is telling us is that prosecution in the adult system assists public safety in the short term, but in the longer run, the public safety gains that are achieved are quickly offset by higher reoffense rates when youths exit the adult system. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we interpret these findings, especially in light of what we know about the development of youths during adolescence. One of the things that we have seen is that youth who go into the adult system are going into institutions that are generally much larger than juvenile institutions, with a higher number of security staff, with lesser numbers of treatment staff, where there's a lot more inmate contact, and where youth have a great deal more idle time, in which they're exposed to more violent and more seasoned older offenders. Juvenile institutions tend to be much smaller. They tend to have many treatment programs, and youth have opportunities to develop competencies that they don't have in the adult system. We did research in Florida where we interviewed 150 youths who were in the juvenile system and a similar number of youth who were in the adult system. And 60% of the youth in the juvenile system said to us that they expected to remain law-abiding in the future. Interestingly, 64% of those in the adult system were uncertain about the future, or they said that they were planning to commit more crime. In speaking about the juvenile system, we know that there is a stronger treatment orientation that addresses mental health needs, learning problems, social skills deficits. The programming in the best juvenile institutions facilitates adolescent development by generating social competencies, a pro-social identity, by encouraging good decision-making and planning, and providing appropriate rewards and sanctions for good and bad behavior. Relative to the juvenile system, the adult system is likely to be criminogenic. Identity formation is shaped in negative ways. Status in the adult inmate culture is based on ability to use violence and to exploit others. Staff degradation, which takes place to an amazing extent in adult institutions, is destructive. The regimentation in adult prisons affords few opportunities for decision making, which is crucial to the development of self-efficacy. And the social development of youth in the adult system tends to be arrested. It's a dog-eat-dog world. They're living in a culture of mistrust. Also, when youth leave adult institutions, besides being ill-equipped to manage adult roles and responsibilities, they also deal with the stigma of criminal conviction, which we know affects prospects for employment, for marriage, for the development of pro-social friendship networks. When a youth has a delinquency record, is retained in the juvenile system, they don't have to deal with those problems that tend to make re-entry into pro-social life so much more difficult. In sum, what I've suggested to you is that the most sophisticated research that we have comparing juvenile and adult conviction and incarceration suggests that transfer, although well-intended in order to protect public safety, is often counterproductive in the long term. Youths can be held accountable in the juvenile system, and youth in the juvenile system can receive the kinds of treatment that will foster their eventual return to law-abiding lives as adults. I'll be happy to take questions if you have them.
All right, Dr. Bishop, thank you very much. Let's see if there are any questions. We do. Representative Barker.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. I'm Jeff Barker. I'm from the Portland suburb of Beaverton area. In Oregon, when there's violent crimes committed under our statutes that have mandatory minimum sentences, people who are 17 years old, for example, will go into the youth authority, and we hold them in the youth authority until they're 25 years old before transferring them into the adult system. I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Well, I think that's an excellent practice, to be sure, because they will have the benefits of the programming that goes on in the Oregon Youth Authority, and I suspect that they're using evidence-based practices, which are very positive. The difficulty arises, of course, when the youth is transferred into the adult system and enters an inmate social world, which is very different from the one that he left in the juvenile system. It's also problematic, as I mentioned, to have an adult conviction because there are all sorts of restrictions on employment, on housing, on education, and so forth that flow from an adult conviction that don't flow from a juvenile record. So in that respect, although what Oregon is doing is certainly very laudable in keeping young people in juvenile institutions, the eventual transfer to adult institutions and the carrying of an adult criminal record are factors that might make things less positive for the youth in the long run.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Yeah, I was wondering, when you were doing your research in Florida, did Florida's correction system have a reentry program out of the prison and back into the community, and did the juvenile system have a reentry program that was designed as part of the when they were in the system?
Yes. At that time, Florida's adult system did not have a reentry program. In fact, because of some negative publicity for inmates who had been out on work release and committed additional offenses, all of the halfway houses and work release programs in Florida for adults were shut down. So there was absolutely no facilitation of reintegration going on in the adult system. There was fairly good reentry programs in the juvenile system, although they've certainly gotten better in the last 5 years or so when we've had a lot more funding and emphasis on reintegration for youth.
So in your research, there was no way to check to see if that was the leading factor or if there were other factors. It was kind of just one of the
other. No, there was no way to check to see whether that was a leading factor. No.
Okay. Thank you.
But it certainly goes hand in hand with the differences between the juvenile and adult system across the board. I should say that in Dr. Fagan's research, I don't believe that in either system, at the time their research was conducted, I don't believe that in either system there were very strong reentry programs.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Other questions or comments? Dr. Bishop, again, thank you very much for spending part of your Friday afternoon with us. We really appreciate your time and your expertise.
Well, thank you for bearing with me as I went through these numbers with you.
Good
day.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
All right, thank you. So we're going to come back to our third panel now, which is going to be former Congressman Darlene Hooley and Dick Whitnell. And for many of you who do not know Dick, Dick was part of the Public Safety Commission with myself and the other co-chairs.
Thank you.
And we thank both of you for taking time in your afternoons to be with us today.
I'm more impressed that you're taking your time with us this afternoon, on a Friday afternoon. I know some of you have long drives to go to your homes. Co-Chair Polansky, Co-Chair Winters, Olson Garrett, and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. For the record, I'm Congresswoman Hooley. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about juveniles, public safety reform, and our criminal justice system. We know you're addressing a very complex issue in a politically charged environment, and we appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you are addressing all of the issues. Thank you for your public service and for your work that you do. As an elected official, I worked for a lot of public safety issues by setting broad public policy at the state and national level, just as you're doing. I was especially involved in the policies around methamphetamine. As a county commissioner, we implemented policies for offenders in jails, for a strong community corrections program, alcohol and drug program. As a mother, I took in young people into our home that they didn't quite know what to do with. They didn't want to lock them up, but they couldn't send them home. As a college student, I volunteered at McLaren, so I've had a lot of dealings with some of these issues. We're here today to talk about the youth who are convicted under ballot measure 11, who are then sentenced to the Department of Corrections. Once sentenced, because of their age, they are then placed in the physical custody of OYA until the age of 25, at which time they are sent to prison. Some of these youth committed very serious crimes. It is not an excuse for their actions, but when we delve into the lives of these youth, we learn that many of them were abused or neglected, and many got involved in drugs or alcohol at an early age. Upon coming to the Oregon Youth Authority, it might be the first time they have had physical safety, some structure, some counseling, and accountability for their actions. For some of these individuals, for those who decide they want to change their lives, they also have Dick with Nell, who is there to help them in going in a different direction and taking a new path. I'm really here to introduce Dick Wisnell, and probably a lot of you don't need an introduction to him. He is a successful business person, a devoted husband, and a family man. He could be spending his retirement days on the golf course or vacationing on exotic beaches.
I don't think so.
Not there. There's a problem with either of those options. But instead, Dick has been a community leader and is working tirelessly to advance public safety reforms. Dick is also a man of action. Once he learned about the importance of early childhood brain development, he became a leader in Marion County Commission on Children and Families, and he led the effort in Salem to recruit 150 foster families to care for children who had been abused or neglected. He also serves on the Early Learning Council. He also serves on the Oregon Education Investment Board. He has had many, many business awards in his work. And again, he's been Salem First Citizen. He's been on the Board of Trustees at Linfield College. And the list goes on and
easy,
on.
Easy, 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 dude.
Okay. Dick has also been mentoring a group of youth men at McLaren, young men who have dramatically changed their lives, grown up, looking forward to their future. These youth are taking advantage of every opportunity to advance their lives. But under the law, it doesn't matter what they do to change. Upon reaching the age of 25, they must go to prison. It doesn't matter if they have 5 months left on their sentence or 15 years. The system offers no hope for these individuals. These young men have changed their lives despite the harsh realities that our system gives them no incentives to do so. We are concerned that once these young men are transferred to prison, they will need to change again to survive in that environment. This makes no sense. The current system is broken and is also very expensive for the taxpayer. Dick will tell you his own story about how he became involved in the lives of these young men and his work with them. His testimony is important because of his firsthand experience and relationship to these individual young men. It is also important because he was the only public member on the Commission of Public Safety. So I say that he speaks for the entire population. He does not work for any branch of government and is not tied to any interest group. Through his work on the commission and because of his relationship with the individuals he mentors at McLaren, he has become a tireless advocate for reform. With that, I give you Dick Wisnow.
Well, thank you, Darlene. That introduction in 372 will get you a gallon of gas just about anywhere. Senator Prokosky, thank you very much for inviting us and the members of the committee. I feel like I've got thrown on the bus just a little bit because I invited my wife of 50 years, Gail, to be with us today, and we had this big section on brain development and maturity, and so I've probably made a mistake there having her here.
Dick, I need you. Dick, I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick Withnell, local business person here in Salem. I've been in the automotive business for a long time, and about 10 years ago, I sold it to my son.
And a few years ago, we had a methamphetamine problem here in Marion County, and I had the opportunity to work with several individuals, including Senator Winters, and we founded Together No Meth Not in Our Neighborhood. And it really worked. We shut down methamphetamine labs, but unfortunately, there was an unintended consequence of the children, and that really started my journey along with others like the late Dick Alexander of Portland and, of course, the late Brian Johnston. To address the needs of the underserved and at risk. And I want to say, and this is of course with myself included, there's not one person in this room who at some place or time have had not someone come alongside of them. The first person that comes to my mind is Ted Winters. I remember Senator Peter Courtney couldn't believe Ted's transformation when he spoke at Ted's celebration of life in the Senate chambers. Dr. Maureen Casey invited me to speak at McLaren's Lord High School graduation a few years ago, and I got to see what the young men accomplished while they were under the commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority. And during my talk, I said that any of them who wanted to continue their education to contact me. Of course, I made a big mistake of giving my contact information to Diane Haas, who I believe is in the audience, and she passed that information on to all the people that heard my voice there. And a young friend of mine, Anthony Hines, took me up on my offer for some education. I didn't do anything, and I really repeat this, I didn't do anything. I just invested in this young man who finally really got it under the direction of OIA personality. Anthony completed his time in custody at Shutter Creek and on the coast and in January 2012. He is living in Portland now, getting great grades. His average is 3.82. No question in my mind, in another 4 years, he'll be a medical doctor, and he's playing just a little bit of basketball. Anthony Hines is one of the tallest friends I have, and he is here with me today. I'd like to just introduce Anthony Hines right here. Anthony, stand up. I want to show you how tall he is. That's good. Thanks, Anthony. Senator Roblin, we know two people that tall now, don't we?
That's right.
Mel counts and Anthony.
That's right.
I played against Mel. Always beat us from Roseburg. As you know, I was on the two public safety commissions, and a number of you were members also, and I represented the public sector, as Representative Hooley said. What I found out about the Oregon correctional system is that it's really not broken. But it certainly could be tweaked. And this is without diluting public safety, but particularly for the knowledge of best practices. And we heard this on the public testimony over the phones by these professionals this past few years. The challenge I see it is going to be a challenge for you, the policymakers, is to determine what is good policy. Mandatory assessing for juveniles is one thing, but what happens in 5, 6, 7 years of a juvenile delinquent when we spend over $750,000 to change the individual's life, and then the continued incarceration upstate to how to be a real criminal? It just doesn't make sense. And you spell that C-E-N-T-S. I believe a policy can be set up to allow custodial supervision with strict regulations and in the community for those who are in this community who have overachieved. Not everyone, but those who have overachieved. Brian Pham is one of them. You just heard this morning or this afternoon, and also Anthony. And I kind of smiled when you said that about the restrictions of them, if we did allow them to go out. I can assure you my investment in Brian and Anthony, I'll be in Department of Community Corrections if they screw up. I told them I'd shoot them myself. And I'm serious.
Wow.
Anthony and I have an engagement of, we're pushing $5,000, so I have a vested interest in his success. And so does his mother. And now so does Gail. And so does Darlene. Yes. So eyes are on them. And so when you're chewing on this thought also, just kind of throw out in the parking lot is, the life sentence of sex offenders who are 15 and 16 is something to ponder. But that's something else we'll talk about later. I hear the good term, good policy, over and over again in this building. And, sometimes good policy runs into politics. And by looking at this committee here, you of all the committees, and I'm going to probably get in trouble with this, but you are the best committee in this building because I happen to know a number of you. And you are policy members. I'm not so sure you're worried about what happens in the caucuses. I'm not so worried of who you're running against next time. I'm not so sure whether you're a D, R, or XYZ. You're going to make good policy. And I think it's really critical when you look at the investment that we make. Think of that, $200+ a day for a young man like this, $700,000. $700,000. And then we want to peel onion back in reverse after we spend that money? I mean, I didn't get very good grades in school, but that doesn't make too much sense to me. So I really hope that you as a committee will come out with some craftiness, some way that we can deal with the Measure 11 folk that who are under custody and who have another, after we spend this kind of money, after we see this kind of, this is not for everybody that's under that custody. These are the overachievers. This Brian Pham, he is an exceptional guy. This Anthony Hines, I'd do anything for this guy. He knows that. He has changed himself around. He's going to be a great citizen. He's going to get a job. He's going to pay taxes. And he's going to buy a car. And not a Ford.
A Ford.
Just had to get that one in. But seriously, when I think of Dick Alexander, who I communicated with, lock him up, throw the key away. He has this aha experience that's not where it is. And Senator Roblin, you know that, of course, you're being an educator. It's down at the bottom. It's that the early education that means it. And so same way with these young people. We heard over the transmissions already today that there can be a transformation, there can be a change, and especially when we've given this opportunity. Oregon Youth Authority does a great job. I mean, I've been in this. Diane Haas and her crew, And the superintendent up there, they do a great job. You represent, you heard that, just you saw that yourself, Senator. So why would we want to degrade that? It just doesn't make sense for these individuals who have overachieved. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick. Questions, comments?
I don't have a...
Senator Williams first.
Well, I've sat here and I've listened, and I didn't know that, of course, Dick and I have been involved a lot in our community, and he knows a lot more about me and my life and Ted than most. But as I sat here today, and I did ask the good Senator Pogranski if he had Ted's book, and he said he did not. I'm going to make certain that every member of this panel has a copy of Lifer. Because as I sat here today and I heard the brain development, and I heard the professionals and the experts talk about the 16-year-old. And for those of you who may or may not know, it was at 17 that he was sent to OSP to learn how to be that bad, bad, bad guy. And also for those of you who know, who don't believe in change, that he did make the change. And the testimony is in this building. On the east wings of this building is a plaque that said, a true pioneer who served two governors and the citizens of the state of Oregon that was put here by this body, and a building at Western Oregon University that's dedicated to Mark P. Ted Winters for the 50-some-odd years of services that he gave to this state. I couldn't help but remember all this today. Because all the things that were talked about today were talked about how a person can change. But it also talked about what happens in the development of young minds and young lives. And I couldn't help but think about having, and I will share the book with all of you on this panel. It's very personal. It's one that he wrote a long time ago about his journey and his life. But more importantly, that here we had an individual who was deemed beyond redemption by one of the tough judges in the state of ours, but who later became at one of the highest levels the assistant to a governor of the state of Oregon. So when we look at life changes and we look at what is possible, I'm going to share with those of you who don't know the story with that life. And I thank you, Dick, for reminding me today and for saying that Ted's journey is throughout this building, that we on this body want to make certain that we do good, sound policies that affect the lives of young people and others in this state.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I'll just make one close one. It was nice that you came down to Shutter Creek so you could walk in the same streets the mill counts did walk. So we do know the two tall people were in the same place. And anyway, it's really, I just want to commend both the young men who have changed, turned their lives around, having been a high school principal. I know how difficult that is, and I know how much help it takes from lots of other people, and I know how much it takes from you individually. And in the final analysis, it is you individually, not all the other people that have to walk those streets every day and walk those evenings and spend those nights with your own thoughts. And, you know, making those changes is a life's venture, and I know that that's the case with our senator's husband. So I commend you for your journey that's just begun, and it is a long one. But you know, thank you for also giving us hope that there are things that we can do to make better lives for people.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Just ditto that, and also, Dick, just want to say I appreciate working with you on the commission.
Yeah,
and,
thanks.
Someday the story is going to have to be written about the work you've done with these kids, and it's really remarkable and a wonderful tribute.
Thanks. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Senator. And I'm one of the committee members that hadn't had the opportunity to serve on judiciary, so I've said I'm a little disadvantaged coming into all of this. It's a rather steep hill, and we've been kind of easing our way into this, and I appreciate that that's our mode of operating. Because I think eventually the rubber will hit the road, and we'll probably be scratching tires, shifting gears, to use some terminology from your industry. And I do want to say, for those young men that have shared their lives, you know, you will constantly be reminded of your mistakes, and you know that, and I appreciate you coming forward and putting it into context today for us. It is a benefit, and I want to assure folks out there that are considering, like, are we even concerned about the victims? Obviously, yes, we are, and I believe that these gentlemen in this case and others are as well. And so finding a way that makes sense and finding good policy over the politics, because we all know, and I've been pretty quiet up until this meeting, and now here I talk, and so forgive me, Senator, but or Mr. Chair, but there's a lot of politics that come into this equation, and I think you hit the nail on the head. I'm convinced that we have a group of folks that are willing to have the discussions that perhaps might be unpopular, politically unpopular, but necessary to get to a process of policy. And so I'm honored to be on the committee. I know we're going to start getting into the details, and I look forward to those discussions. And I also just look forward to those folks coming forward to admit their mistakes, be honest about what they've done in the past, and continue to shed light on your future. It's not going to be easy. You can't give up. You're on a roll now. You got to just keep it going. But thanks for being here today, and thank you all.
Senator Reyes, may I just say speaking for Darlene, but she's the one that's knows what's going on in this type of situation. But I assure you, then you can count me in, and I know you can, Darlene. We'll do anything that you ask to put that to talk to the outside population, to the general electorate out there about this information that you guys have just received. So if anything that you need, I'll be happy to carry any amount of water. I'm really focused on this, and I know Darlene is, and we'll do anything together. We're kind of a mutton, Jeff. And she doesn't.
I want to know who's the mutton.
I'm offline for that one.
Opposite bookends, maybe. But I'm telling you, we are one on this deal.
We're
one on this deal. So any water you want us to carry, put us down. Seriously.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. As you've heard from others, I feel remiss if I didn't also thank you for all the work you've done. Our relationship has only been a couple of years. You're a true individual, a person who believes and follows your ways, and you bring forward examples in these two young men and having the ability to, one, for themselves wanting to make a change, two, taking the responsibility for their actions, but having mentors, individuals within the community that are willing to actually bet the bank on these individuals. And I can only share from my perspective as a family member who lost a sister to a murder, this is the type of stuff that's tough, very tough,
It means a lot for victims, and I can only speak for myself, not for others. But this is what makes the opportunity for us to move forward, to have individuals get reintegrated back into the communities and be positive forces, being paying taxes, and then hopefully when they continue their lives and have families, be able to be the mentors and the examples for their families.
Exactly.
So thank you very much.
If I just may say one last word. I think we all know that the system is broken. And I've been an elected official in several different positions. I know how hard these kinds of decisions are. So I don't envy you in making those decisions. But you really do have a chance to make things better. And as Dick said, we will do anything we can do to support you, help you, talk, whatever you need us to do. But we think this is really important, and it is nice to be teamed with someone like Dick Withnow, who has taken the bull by the horns and said, I'm going to make a difference in this state, in this city. And it's just a privilege to work with him. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for the tough decisions that you have to make.
Mr. Co-Chair,
yes.
I just need to say a special, and I'm not going to say it to Dick, because I'm going to say it to Gail Withnow. And I'm going to say a special thank you to her, because, you know, Dick, we all know in the community, but the huge support and support that goes with Dick is the wife, Gail Withnow, and I just need to say that. Dick can, you know, chide me about Ford versus Dodges, but and the generous heart, but there's two generous hearts. And some people mistake generous hearts for not requiring accountability. Yeah. The two of them do expect accountability. Yeah. I need to put that on the record because, you know, often I think people confuse those two. And I know that their two expectations is that the individuals that they are investing both their heart and their dollars with are expecting some great outcomes.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one last panel for this afternoon. Christina McCann and Jeff McMillan, I want you to please come forward. Thanks to both of you for being willing to be with us today, and we'll take in the order that whoever wants to present first.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, co-chairs and members of the committee. Boy, that is a tough act to follow, so I'm going to do my best. But my name is Christina McMahon. I am the Juvenile Services Division Director for Multnomah County's Department of Community Justice. That's my current position. My background is that I have served as a prosecutor. I started my career in Marion County, right here in Salem, and then went over to Deschutes County before changing careers and becoming a juvenile department director in Douglas County, and then almost 2 years ago coming to Multnomah County. So I just wanted you to be aware I have a strong value in accountability to victims and the community, as well as a very strong belief that people really can change for the better. I wanted to share a little bit of information with you about coming from the largest metropolitan county in the state. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about what the impacts of Measure 11 and adult waivers into that you've heard about today have in my community. There are currently 160 Multnomah County youth that are in Oregon Youth Authority correctional facility beds. Of those 160, 108 of them, or 68% of them, are Measure 11 or adult waived youth. So the vast majority of them are in on adult charges. The total population of adult waived and Measure 11 cases, people that are incarcerated in the youth correctional facilities changes, but when I ran this report last week, it was at 340. And of the 340, 32% of those young people were from Multnomah County. So this is a big issue in our community. Another thing that is of a major issue to us is we have some disproportionate impacts in our community to youth of color. 73% last year in 2012, 73% of the young people who were convicted under Measure 11 or waived as adult were youth of color, 41% being African American. So when I see the number 73%, that is staggering to me, and that's something that we need to work on as a system. Of those 101 kids or young people that went in, some of them aren't kids anymore, but 52 of the 101 were incarcerated on robbery charges. So I thought that that was an important factor for you to take into your consideration as you're making these policy choices. I wanted to talk to you today specifically about earned review for youth offenders, the second look hearings that are part of House Bill 3194. I think it's really important that everyone understand, and I'm sure most of you do, but just for the record, that these types of hearings are actually judicial proceedings. These are not administrative hearings. These are hearings that require the youth authority and the state to go back to court before a judge and determine whether the individual has been rehabilitated and reformed. In making that determination, the judge must consider several things, including the progress the young person has made, the original crime, the severity, the impact on the victim, and the victim has a right to be heard. So these are serious hearings that require judicial oversight. The youth offender has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that the person has been rehabilitated and reformed, and if conditionally released, the person would not be a threat to the safety of the victim's family, or the community, and that the person would comply with the release conditions. Those are findings that the court must make in order for the young person to be released. Everything in House Bill 3194 is prospective. I know there's concerns about what are going to be the impacts if 3194 with regard to second look went through. That means that none of these, the shortest sentence under Measure 11 is 75 months. So none of these hearings would take place until sometime in 2017 or 2018. If the law was enacted. So I don't think there would be a glut of these types of hearings, because according to estimates that I've received through the Oregon Crime Commission, the estimate is approximately 15 per month. In our county, we believe that allowing parole for these less serious offenders is for not, I don't want to say that all Measure 11 or adult waived are less serious. I know you've heard a lot about risk and brain development, but there is a significant portion of these young people that are less serious. One thing I forgot to mention that I meant to say at the very beginning is we recently had a visitor from the Oregon Youth Authority. A young man who is incarcerated at McLaren came to our Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association meeting last month and presented to us. He is a young man from Multnomah County who at the age of 17 and a half was with a cousin, showed up at the cousin's friend's house. The cousin pulled a gun, held up the resident of the home. This young man ended up being charged with robbery in the second degree and ended up taking a plea deal that involved not being able to have he waived his right to a second look hearing. So that young man went into the Oregon Youth Correctional Facility in June of 2011. If everything goes as planned, he will get out in June of 2015. I met with him recently at McLaren and had a long discussion with him about his story and his background. And I also spoke to the officials at McLaren who shared with me that this young man has done, he was actually a low-risk offender. He had no history of juvenile adjudications in the system before he got this. He was a first-time one strike, you're out individual. So he went in as a low-risk offender and really doesn't need treatment. He didn't have substance abuse issues, wasn't in need of much work in terms of his behavior challenges. He has now risen to the highest behavior level at McLaren. He is a peer mentor. He spends his time helping other young people who have come in to try to help them be successful. So I'm hoping and praying that in the next 2 years and 3 months, while he's waiting for his time to tick by, he continues to be a positive force. So for me, it's a very recent personal example of an individual who's impacted by our current system and the constraints on it. Allowing offenders such as the young man I just described to have an opportunity for a second look hearing would should be considered for several reasons. The Oregon Youth Authority has youth correctional facility capacity to only a limited amount for kids that are involved in the juvenile justice system, and it's impacted by the number of kids who are in on Measure 11 and adult waived cases, and I know my colleague will speak more to that. But those limited resources that we have should be saved for the most dangerous youth who need more services to be rehabilitated. As you've heard this afternoon, research in brain science has enlightened us about adolescent brain development, and we know much more now than we did back in 1995 when Senate Bill 1 was enacted. Most youth offenders, I have personal experience seeing this, are amenable to change. The vast majority of them do turn their lives around. When we lost 150 OYA youth correctional facility beds in the last few years, that made clear the need for enhanced flexibility for the 300 to 350 youth offenders treated as adults. We have many youth who have accepted responsibility for the crimes they have committed, served time, have engaged in the work to effect meaningful personal rehabilitation, and are waiting out sometimes very lengthy sentences. And I ask, is this a good use of limited public resources? I would also say that when you're looking at the opportunity to reform the continuum of how we work or deal with juvenile offenders in the system, on one end of the continuum, in a very conservative way, is the second look hearings, because it's the default is that those young people stay in. It's not an automatic that they will be released. I would also ask that in this time of potentially courageous political policy decisions, that you also consider in that reform continuum some level of restoration of judicial discretion to the process. And prior to the enactment of Senate Bill 1, judges did have the ability to look at an individual youth's circumstances and the many variables and the gravity of the crime and make a decision as to whether or not they should stay in the adult system or stay in the juvenile system or go to the adult system. So with all the advances that we've made in juvenile justice by utilizing evidence-based practice, brain research information, risk assessment tools, the data that we have on what works, there is truly an opportunity, if we keep more kids in the juvenile justice system, to have the kind of positive outcomes that we all hope for, that are not just of societal value, but that make sense economically. So I'd just like to end by, as you're grappling with the tough decisions that you have to make this session related to public safety and to the fiscal impacts, I'd like to just share one of my favorite quotes with you that I think is fitting. It's from James Baldwin. "For these are all our children. We will all profit by or pay for whatever they become." Thank you for your time.
Jeff.
Hello, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Milligan. I work with the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium. And there's a handout, I think, that you've got
there
here.
Is.
Which is kind of a reference thing because I don't have very much time, and there's some items in here you may want to look at later. The map on the front kind of shows the over 61,000 square miles. Of course, there are rural counties on the coast and in southern Oregon, but our group is an intergovernmental kind of special district that was formed to kind of pool resources and manage limited resources. There's a little chart after that on the demographics, cultural and ethnic diversity of our area. It's just interesting in contrast to Multnomah County. We have like 1% of the youth in our area are African American, and those that are there are sports stars and student body presidents, and it's interesting. But anyway, what I wanted in the very short time I have is to explain to you that our region generated about 220 some youth that are in the Youth Authority's custody. That's kind of a general figure of Measure 11 and other kinds of youth. And there's a chart in the third page in that there's been a myth around, or misperception maybe, that youth east of the mountains or in rural communities aren't that risky or not, you know, then what do, you know? But that's really not true. And we had the research section led by Dr. Blatty and others really compare the profiles, the risk profiles and the needs profiles of the youth in our area to all other youth. And what he found in looking at the chart here is that it's higher than every category except alcohol. So the youth that our folks finally identify as really in need of public safety interventions and whatever are equally as risky. The numbers aren't as large as Christina's county and whatever, but the youth that we do have east of the mountains do need services, do need accountability and whatever else, and public safety is an issue. And of course, all these, there is also victims involved and whatever. So I just, that's one perception I wanted to correct, that really the total number is less, but the need for intervention and services is there. Rural communities, of course, crime is very visible. Victims are very visible. The best thing about a rural community is everyone knows you. The worst thing about a rural community is everyone knows you. And so everybody knows, you know, victims and whatever. And there is an attitude that community wants, it's very visible, so you have to act quickly. And that's where the early intervention, the juvenile crime prevention efforts, to identify youth at imminent risk of entering the system are real important. We're monitoring the change from over to, I guess, the Youth Development Council to see what happens to those resources. That's very important. But I guess in kind of winding up here, we're very excited about the Youth Reformation System presentation that you heard, because in rural counties with very, very limited services, you've got to be real strategic. You've got to target what limited services you have to the youth that present the highest risk. That's what Christina just talked about, in a rural community as well as in an urban community. And as we get better and better at that, with good predictions and informed professional judgment and information from schools, law enforcement, and other agencies, rural communities with limited services, limited budgets, whatever else, can really be strategic about making sure they're targeted. And that's what we're really looking forward to, and we're becoming one of the pilots in OIA to look at how this might work in a rural community. And then just a final pitch, I guess, is that there's some really exciting stuff happening in the system. Juvenile departments are doing some great work in different ways. We've been collaborating with Multnomah a little bit about how to improve the skills of parents and families and communities. That's the nemesis issue about managing more people in the community, is what do you do with the families? And so there's a lot of really exciting stuff going on. The work that's going on in OIA is very exciting. And so this is a time really to keep the system as much whole as we can, because there's a real forward movement going on between all of the juvenile departments, east, west, south, wherever, and the great leadership that the Youth Authority is bringing forward on being real smart about how to handle this stuff. So thank you very much. I did include in the back of this handout just a little short overview of how the juvenile justice system works. It's very high flyover, and it also does include this chart in the back. A lot of people say, gosh, what in the world is that? Looks like how you program a VCR or a DVD. But really what that is designed to be individualized and flexible. That's kind of, I think, what other people have said, is the system is designed to fit the youth. And that's why all of these lines and charts and graphs go everywhere, so that you can very individually target the specific needs of a youth and get them back on track, like Dick Withnell talks about, back to a productive life. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and if you need any further information from us, we'd be glad to provide it for you.
Well, thank you. Let's see if there's any questions at this point, comments.
I have a quick one.
Sure, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McMahon, can you just tell me, in the second look, proceedings. You said they're judicial. Does the victim have a role in that? Are they, in some cases, because victims, you know, express their request for leniency, mm-hmm. but in ballot measure 11, they can't have that. I'm just curious, what's their role in that proceeding?
Yes, actually, there are several sections of the statute that address the victim, and they are, the DA is able, the district attorney is able to subpoena or ask the witness, different witnesses to come, including victims. But the specific parts of the statute that address that are whether the person, the offender, has made and will continue to make restitution to the victim in the community, and the safety of the victim's family, and the community have to be considered in addition to any testimony that the victim provides.
Thank you.
I want to make one comment, and I think it really comes back to what, Christina, you were saying. If I got it right, you said 52 out of, I think you said 101 youth that are in OIA are there on robbery charges.
No, we had in 2012, I'm sorry, I might have misheard through that. No, in Multnomah County in 2012, we had 101 youth who were treated either under Measure 11 or waived as adults, and 52 went into the system on robbery charges.
All right.
So basically half.
All right. And so at 101, all of them are in the OIA system to the sense that they will be transferred into the Department of Corrections?
Well, they're considered Department of Corrections
right.
individuals in the OIA system,
right.
yes, in 2012.
Okay. And I think the reason I want to make that point, because what we heard on the from the other individuals in the first panel, I think it was Jennifer Willard, if I'm not mistaken, or it might have been Dr. Bishop, as to what the state failure rate is as to for reoffending for those who are being transferred into the adult system. And it sounds like, you know, we can show here in Oregon we have a fair share that will more than likely be continual problems and be, you say, involved in the criminal justice system beyond their time that they were here just because of how we're treating them.
Right. There is an, and I think Dr. Paul Bilotti has done some great work here in Oregon to show that there's actually actual data that shows that keeping them incarcerated might actually be doing more harm. So.
Yeah. Right. Thank you. Senator Robleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in fact, do we have a, do you ever do a chart that shows how many months they're going to have to do in the correctional system based on their age when they went in and the length of the stay? Mm-hmm. How many of them will actually get done while they're still in OA, but how many will not get done and therefore go into the other system? Do we know that?
I don't have that information, but I'm sure that that's something that we could work with the Oregon Youth Authority
that would be good to
come
know,
up
I
with.
I was going to say, I would assume most of them are probably going to be going in as compared
no, because
to
6 and a half years right. is the sentence, and so they won't reach, most of them will not reach 25.
25, okay.
So that's hopefully
that's
most of them.
That's what I was getting at, because they had told me that it was 6 and a half years.
Yeah.
And 6 and a half years, if they're at 17, mm-hmm. they can make it. So, I mean, it's, but a bunch of the others are for crimes that are bigger than 6. It could be longer
right.
than that. So, yeah, I would really like to know that number.
But I also think that the issue somebody raised about dead time.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's just as, well, may not be the same as, but it is also a problem. And that we have seen the studies that have indicated that when you don't have the hope to get out sooner, you lose some of the stuff you gain when you.
Right.
Yeah, we've seen that too.
All right. Well, thank you again very much for being here. And I believe this concludes our meeting for today. Is there anything else we need to cover?
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
There it is. Oh, thank you.